talk is actually built for me. I'm Janet Wiles, but it's work done with Brad Imani and Rusty Gage at the Salk. And so I'm going to give the brief intro at the beginning, a bit of background, a little bit about neurogenesis, and its role, we think, in timing, and then just a very brief intro to the modelling aspects, and then Brad Imani, who's been doing the modelling work, is going to actually present our results. Okay, so what we're talking about, neurogenesis and dentate gyrus, is a very specific biological phenomena, that you have new brain cells. In the adult brain, mostly, you have very few of them, and they're restricted to two particular regions. One is the dentate gyrus, which is deep in the memory region, and the other is in olfactory. We're going to be talking about within the dentate gyrus. And there are two aspects of timing in particular that are very interesting about these cells. One, actually Gary's intro fits in very nicely here, is that newborn neurons in dentate are very active. So where dentate itself is a very quiet region most of the time, these newborn neurons are two-year-olds. They're just yelling and screaming all the time. And then that's happening in a very short time range. You know, when we remember the moment, the instant is happening in seconds, or milliseconds to seconds. But what we're remembering is events over a lifetime. Okay, so the second aspect of time in these new cells, which is very interesting, is the fact that the newborn neurons that got born this morning, you're not using at the moment. They're actually maturing over time. You'll be using them in a month, 2 months' time. Okay, so this is part of the... So the dentate gyrus is part of the hippocampus. We have the CA3 here. Here's the dentate here. We've got the granule cell, which are the principal excitatory cell types, and then we've got entorhinal cortex. So this is where your information's coming in. Your newborn neurons, if you can see the green cells here, it's showing a cartoon sketch of them maturing over time. So what we've got is when they're very young, like all newborn cells, it's just a blob. It's not doing anything much. Then 3 days to a week, you're getting processes extended. GABA at this stage is excitatory. Over 2 weeks, these are the dendrites extending into the molecular layer, so they're picking up the input from entorhinal cortex. And entorhinal cortex is where you've got your grid cells and other inputs coming in from the cortex. So this is where you're getting your information about the spatial world and the objects or context of that. Then over time, GABA is inhibitory. It's extending its axon processes out, and these are connecting into CA3. Now, the dentate itself is a very ancient component of the brain. You go back and, you know, it's certainly there in all the mammals. Go back, reptiles have it. There are components probably going back at least 300 million, possibly longer. So the connections, the actual way it connects in here and connects out here changes between species, but the fact that it's there and its role, what's it actually doing? So your theory of what newborn neurons in dentate does depends a lot on your theory of what dentate does, and that depends on what your theory of what hippocampus does and the particular species you deal with or how you're studying it. Okay, so this is from Niram Lee and Hargraves. This is a model here showing spatial information processing. Okay, so the spatial information, the medial entorhinal cortex, if you follow particularly the rat literature, you will have come across grid cells. Your grid cells are in MEC here. This feeding through CA1, and there's actually a circuit going on here. Now, there's also, so this is the what, this is the where pathway, in a way. Then you also have non-spatial information. Now, some people think of this as being objects. Some people think of it as being context, depending on how you characterize it. So you've got other information coming through. This is the lateral entorhinal cortex. We have much less information about what's actually being recorded in these cells. It's a much harder region to record from, and there aren't nearly as many stable cells in terms of things like location. So you've got your lateral and your medial. That information is coming, entorhinal cortex, coming into, here's your hippocampus. Now, CA3 is where a lot of the recording is done. So this is where you've got your place cells. So if you're interested in spatial navigation. And my interest in this came from a robotics viewpoint. We have a little robot that roams the corridors and creates maps, and it's doing it based on a map of what's going on in CA3 together with grid cells from MEC. Okay, so dentate gyrus is an input region into here. Some people emphasize the links that come into dentate and then into CA3. And it's interesting, what you're doing at this point here is taking, in a rat, a fairly active, so your MEC cells, your grid cells are active. So if you think of it as a representation, it's fairly dense. Going to a very sparse representation here. So just the mathematics of going from 250,000 cells to a million cells as you go from MEC to your granule cell layer here, you're going to go into a much sparser region. It's going to be easier to separate. You're going to have aspects of learning that are just much easier at this point here. And then that's feeding into an attractor system. There's a different way. So if you emphasize the separation aspects, you'll emphasize the DG-CA3 link. If you emphasize the recurrent connection aspect, you'll emphasize the CA3 and what's being stored there. And there are different theories about how this connects up. The other way of looking at this, so what we've got is the where and the what. The other way of looking at is from the architecture itself, looking at the regions, the different layers of entorhinal cortex, how they come in. This green here is CA3 going through to CA1. So you can do a bottom-up model and say, if you just put together these cells and connect them the way the system's connected, what does it do? You've got different perspectives on how you might model. There are a number of different theories. So the original theories about dentate go back to Cajal, so in the early 1900s, where what you've got is the dentate and an emphasis on entorhinal cortex, dentate, CA3, CA1, so this loop here, and that's the separation idea. Then there's a whole series of others. Trees and Rolls have a very nice model here where what you're doing is emphasizing CA3. The interesting thing about space, which is not just the perception, the visual world, but going into a particular area, I can be in the same location and the views are similar. Everything's coherent and I know where I am. I can be in the same place, but the views are different. Now, if you're a space cell, if you're a place cell, you know where you are in space. If I close my eyes, the view is very different, and yet I'm in the same location in space. So for a rat, place cells are stable in the dark until they start to drift. So what you want in a system that's designed to represent navigation and space is to know where you are regardless of different views. The other thing that happens in space is that you can have similar views, but you're actually at different locations in space. So even though you've got a similar input coming in, if you know you're in a certain region, it's a white wall here, it's a white wall there, they're both white walls, but they're not evidence that you want to confuse. We actually have quite distinct representations of place. And talking to Paul Munro, he was saying the same thing with faces. You can know who a person is, even though their face is changing, and you can have two people who look very similar, but they're distinct people. So you don't want to confuse just the visual input with what you know about either the identity or the space. Okay, so one of the interesting things about CA3 is you've got attractors. When do you want to go to the best attractor you've got versus when do you want to create a whole new attractor and be able to learn the representations? And quite often very similar attractors, you'd like to be able to pull them apart. One of the really elegant theories of dentate gyrus is that it's helping you distinguish between when you want to create a new attractor, and there's a lot of learning involved in that, or when you'd like to retrieve the best match, even if it's a poor match, but the best match for the current attractor. Okay, and dentate is particularly active in novel environments. Okay, then there's a really interesting story about the way this might train the cortex and the role in sleep. And then this is Sue Becker's model, which is very similar to the architecture in Trees and Rolls, where you have the dentate gyrus feeding through to CA3 and CA1. Now, we're going to be just modelling this part here, so a lot of these theories would fit in whichever way you do it. Okay, so what we've got is what and where. But the interesting thing about episodes is it's not just what is the object and where is it, but also when. You can have the same object and the same place, but depending on whether it's today, tomorrow, or next week, it can be quite distinct. And the question is, where does when come into this? So what we're interested in here is, how does time, where does the when come from in memory? And particularly when we're looking at things like spatial navigation, if you know where the fruit trees are, you know their fruit trees, you know their location, but it matters whether you're in spring or summer if you're hungry and you're looking for the actual fruit. So there's a big distinction in terms of the timing, and for the point of view of our work, timing over weeks to months, over quite distinct periods of time. So I'm going to finish at this point here, and Brad will follow on with the model itself.
So I'm just going to quickly go over the modeling work that we've done to look at how neurogenesis might be involved in encoding temporal information into episodic memories. So I'm not going to go into all the details of the model. This work was recently published, and I'm happy to talk about it with you after in the break, because we're short on time. But the basic idea is we have a model of dentate gyrus, multi-layer model with several hundred or thousand individual neurons being simulated. And instead of having a static network model, as is often the case, what we actually do is gradually incorporate the neurons, new neurons, into the network in the granule cell layer according to the slow maturation process that Janet described earlier. And the model starts off basically with no granule cells and gradually adds them up as like a developing brain would do. So the model proceeds through multiple environments, spends a long amount of time in each one, and I change those environments in series, and then I stop neurogenesis in some and keep neurogenesis in others. So there are several timescales at which neurogenesis may be affecting time, and the first one is actually in a more immediate sense, and that is if events are coming in very rapidly, the hypothesis out there would be that the dentate is doing pattern separation on everything coming in. And if you study pattern separation in the model, and just by varying the inputs, measuring the similarity of the inputs, and looking at the similarity of the outputs, this blue line down here shows you that networks without neurogenesis are very effective at pattern separation. So anything below this diagonal line is pattern separation. So, and what we observe is that when you have new neurons, immature neurons, that are these more excitable units, they actually decrease the pattern separation function. You end up having increased similarity of what's going on. And while this might be bad for a pattern separation function, what we hypothesize is that it allows associations to be formed between, you know, you don't want to over-separate memories or inputs coming into the hippocampus at very fine scales. You want to be able to allow some associations between things happening around the same time if there's temporal similarity. And so the flip side of that is, you know, these new cells are continuously maturing in the network. So they're not staying in this hyperexcitable state for a short time. They actually only are in that state for several days. You know, it's not quite yet defined, but we know that they are fully mature. Once they're fully mature, they're quiet and, well, and more pattern separators. And when you measure pattern separation in the model, as you space out events, so you get into some of these spacing ideas, the further apart events are in their encoding, they're activating distinct sets of immature neurons. And as a result, they're encoded more independently. There's better pattern separation between events further apart in time than those two events if they occurred close in time. So this idea that these new neurons can be allowing temporal separation on the order of days or weeks provides a way that we think that you can cluster memories together according to when they were occurring. So the question still remains, what are these cells doing over long periods of time? So they don't die off after they leave this excitable state. A lot of them stay in the network indefinitely. And so what we did is that after the network grew to, you know, this older state, we went back and tested the network in each of the environments that it was exposed to at the earlier stages. And what we observed is that the young cells the now mature cells that were young at these early stages were preferentially activated by the events, by these environments upon your exposure. So these are different cells in the vertical here, and the different environments are in horizontal. And it's all being tested either at this point or at this point. And what we observe is that there are these clusters of cells that were maturing between day 40 and 80, for example, that are preferentially activated during the new encoding of events that are occurring within environment 2 or of an environment similar to context 2. And so this suggests that actually the dentate, a mature dentate of mature cells, is actually consists of a whole population of specialized neurons that are have grown and formed connections that are well-suited to perform memory, to help in memory encoding to past environments and past experiences. And so in a way, you're encoding, you're developed a structure which is temporally specific units. This idea is actually can be, to wrap up with an example, there's some profound implications with something like aging or stress, events that decrease neurogenesis. And you can see quite clearly from this graph on the left that as the network is exposed to more and more environments with decreasing number of new neurons, the size of these specialized groups of cells decreases considerably. So in an older model, what you end up getting is very few neurons specializing to the events that had recently occurred. Likewise, in a stress condition, so to model stress, what we see in biologically is that new neurons will drop considerably during times of stress or depression. And so when you model stress in this system, you end up seeing a very small number of cells specializing to the environments that follow the stressful period. And it will, unlike aging, leaving the stress state will actually recover neurogenesis. And so the model was able to form representations for the events that occurred after the stressful period, well after. So anyway, that wraps up our modeling results. And like I said, I'm happy to talk to you all in the break. I know that coffee's calling for most of us. So this paper just came out a few weeks ago. So if you're interested in more, thank you.
So Brad, it seems like, I haven't read your paper, but it seems like the model is based on the prediction or the idea that the new neuron, your model seems to be based on the prediction or the idea that new neurons
will be most plastic in terms of plasticity of their inputs onto those cells in the first X number of weeks after they're born, and then less so after that. Is that really known from experimental data that that's true?
It's been observed in actually, several, probably four or five different slice physiology studies. These haven't been looked at in vivo, but when you can label young cells using retrovirus expressing GFP, and when you in an adult slice, you can measure the single-cell LTP under different paradigms. I think both LTP and LTD actually is easier to accomplish in young cells, and it has a higher rate or higher level. So it's hard to extrapolate slice work to in vivo. You can only do that so much. But as far as what we have, all the evidence points to that.